Hey everybody, it's Jamie Cullum here, back with another Hour of Jazz here on BBC Radio 2. And tonight we really have something special for you, because for the whole programme I'm going to be talking to Mr. Wynton Marsalis, the trumpeter, bandleader, composer, educator and all-round inspiration. We're going to be hearing about his new album with Eric Clapton, his lifetime playing and talking about the music he loves, jazz. But first, here he is proving that he is just the greatest technician and just the greatest musician on the tune Cherokee, from his album Standard Time, Volume 1. I'm Jamie Cullum, you're listening to BBC Radio 2, and I'm very, very excited to be sitting opposite a man who I've seen in concert in so many different places, probably over 15 times. I've run up to him after gigs with albums and books and photographs, and he's always signed them very graciously. I'm sitting opposite Mr. Wynton Marsalis.
Hey, it's great to be here. You're saying that, but I'm very proud of what you have done. You know, you come out and you maintain the level of pure seriousness about the music, have turned so many people on to it and brought the joy of it too.
Well, thank you so much. When you decided to do a concert with Eric Clapton, did you feel there was a unique challenge to put together a concert with a very mainstream blues artist like Eric Clapton?
There was no challenge at all for us in terms of the material. I've known him for years, and we have a friendship. We talk about music all the time. And it's always in detail. He'll send me a list of songs, and did you check this out and this out and this out? There's always different types of regional blues and things that I would not be aware of. And we didn't have to make any adjustment in terms of our concept of music to play together. It was just a matter of working out the arrangements and knowing where we would, who would solo where and who would play. And Eric is very serious about practicing, and he'll send you stuff over the telephone. Man, check this riff out. We actually had a dispute over one where a line was. I wrote an arrangement. I wrote the entire line beat away from where it was. So I was arguing with him the whole time about where's this beat, where's this beat. And we sat up and rehearsed a song piece entitled Jolly at Bound. And the beat, it actually was where he said it was. He heard it like three repetitions. And where I was hearing it was not. So the other cats of the band were like, I don't know, man. The guy's not going to play the bass a half a beat away from one. So things like that happen with us as musicians. You know, we have a life as musicians. And when we come out of songs, American popular song, blues, English songs that have chord changes, we don't have to, like you and I, we're speaking the same language. It's not like I'm in Russia and I'm trying to figure out what you're saying or where you're coming from. Mm. We have a common language that makes it easy for us to work together.
What was the name of the tune that you were discussing the missing beat?
Jolly at Bound.
Right. Well, I think can you give us a little bit on what that tune, where that tune is from, and then we're gonna hear it.
Memphis Minnie. They're talking about Jolly at prison.
Let's hear it right now. Joy at Bound from Wynton Marsalis and Eric Clapton live from Jazz at the Lincoln Center. That's the brand new album, and it's a beautiful record from a live concert at the Lincoln Center. I wondered whether putting this concert together actually gave you a different perspective on what you were doing, because obviously the focus of the album for me, of the concert, is this kind of New Orleans kind of jump blues. It's almost like the kind of blues that you would dance to or party to.
Right.
That's always something I felt was missing from a lot of jazz that I went to go and see when I was between the age of 12 and 16.
Well, from I grew up playing dance music. My father played jazz. I love jazz. But I think that the music is also dance music. And it's important to always have the neighborhood and the dance element in the music. And I try to to keep that in the music. And Eric also being a person who loves the blues, who loves that feeling, and a rhythm guitarist. He plays a really great rhythm. He likes the feeling of the music jumping and hopping, and we all do. It's the kind of common thing that comes from African music, the combination of the six and the four when they come together. It has that lift and the bounce. He chose the set list, and I noticed when he sent me the list of the songs, he sent me recordings of these songs that he liked, because I did all of the arrangements. And his every song had a different meaning, came from a different region. It showed a different aspect of the blues. Just the list that he gave me alone, the list itself. When I started to write back to him what I conceived of each song as, it covered such a range of material, and it was an example of his the sophistication of his understanding of the blues as music, a total music. So when it came time for us to do it, yeah, I learned. I always learn a lot playing with any music or any type of music. But to have someone who comes from England who's inspired by the blues to come into a territory that I know, that in a region that I grew up with, and have that type of wide-ranging conception, it was in his concert, was something that could teach me about a thing I grew up with. It's part of the beauty of being a human being.
Let's hear one more track from the album now. This is a very different version of Eric Clapton's most famous song, Layla, arranged by the bass player Carlos Enriquez. You've never heard it like this before. Layla, got me on my knees. Layla, begging for me. That's part of a very different live performance of Layla from the album Play the Blues, featuring Eric Clapton and my guest this evening, Wynton Marsalis. Hi, it's me, Jamie Cullum. I'm here with Wynton Marsalis on BBC Radio 2. Now, I've just had a daughter. She's 5.5 months old. And one of the questions I keep getting asked is, are you going to make her play the piano? Are you going to make her play music? Are you going to make her sing? And you grew up in about as musical an environment as it could be. You grew up in a musical place. Your father was a jazz musician. But I remember that, I believe you said that he didn't push you. He just led by example.
Right. He liked music. You see him listening to it. You see him practicing. He played. He went to hear people. I never forget seeing my father watch people while they were playing. Could be students, he'd be the worst band you ever heard. He would listen to them very intently. And, you know, he liked to talk, but he liked to listen. And he never forced any of us to play. He didn't do that. And with my own kids, I have four kids. I did not force my kids to play music. They don't. They play, they're amateur musicians. They like music. But I'm not a fan of forcing kids into, their talent may not be in music. And they should always have an embracing attitude about art and about things that are instructional. All education is not school. And I think I learned the joy of seriousness from my father. I always like to say he would be serious, but he had a good time being serious.
So did you see a path through your kind of musical journey? Obviously, I believe you didn't really start to take the trumpet seriously until you were 12 years old, which I guess some people would say is quite late.
Right.
I didn't take music seriously till I was 16, you know. It was something that was fun. I was a listener. In fact, I still think of myself primarily as a listener.
But have you noticed your listening changing?
Well, I noticed that I'm hearing, especially in ensemble music, I noticed that I'm starting to hear different instruments that I didn't know existed. Because I have not studied composition. I've not studied music at all. But I'm gradually, through my bandmates who are starting to teach me as I go along, starting to hear, you know, bassoons and and right. flutes and instruments that are in there. And that's something that's very new in the last like couple of years.
It's interesting. A lot of times those low mid-range instruments, French horns, bassoons, low saxophones, what I call them pad instruments or violas, they always seem like they're...
Well, I'm starting to become obsessed with French horns. I want to hear French horns. I want to hear French horns and everything. But the sound of the trumpet, who was it you heard playing the trumpet that made you want to play?
Freddie Hubbard and Miles and Clifford Brown. That was like the three main trumpet players that I liked. And some I met, Clark Terry. I met him actually when I was 13 or 14. He had a great influence on me. And Blue Mitchell, I had a chance to hang with Blue. Because my father was a musician, I was always around the musicians. And Blue Mitchell, I loved him.
So your father would take you to see people in New Orleans?
Well, he would be playing with them.
Right, of course.
So, you know, I would naturally see them. And then when I got to be in high school, my brother and I were playing a lot of gigs. We were gigging almost every night. But maybe playing pop music, but I would play in church sometimes with my friends. And you're talking about your band members. You know, it's interesting. A lot of times for us as musicians, the greatest influence on you would be people you play with. So, you know, like what you were saying, the musicians I played with took me into different environments. And in the jazz environment, there were a couple of clubs people would play. Le Club in the Hyatt Regency. Roses was a club on Chapultepec Street where the national people would come in. So I always would go there. I met Dizzy, Art Blakey. My father always had a picture of him and James Black, a great New Orleans drummer and composer, standing with John Coltrane in the early 60s. Train came to New Orleans and played at a club called Vernon's.
Well, I know that Coltrane was a very important musician to you. It's important to all of us, but particularly the Giant Steps album was a turning point for you, wasn't it?
That's the first jazz record I really listened to. That was like the summer when I was 12. I was mainly listening to pop music, whatever was on the radio, like all of my friends. And then it was one night I could see all of our records were laid out on the ground, my brother and I, and all of my father's records. Not all of them, but we. And I noticed that all of our records, people had some kind of wild costumes on and looked stupid. And I noticed all of my father's records, they looked much more sophisticated. And I started to, just from a visual standpoint, I said, let me put on this record and listen to it. Because even though I grew up in the environment with him, it would never dawn on me to listen to that record. Because I was very much segregated and ignorant and a victim of the marketing. You know, you separate the generations and the young and the old and all of that. That was a turning point for me in my life because when I put the music on, I didn't hear it as old music. I just, John Coltrane, it's like he was speaking to me. And I wanted to learn how to play like that.
Can you think of one particular track off that album that really, really spoke to you?
Cousin Mary.
Cousin Mary,
I like the cry in the music.
Yeah. Let's hear Cousin Mary from Giant Steps, John Coltrane. That was Cousin Mary from the classic John Coltrane album, Giant Steps. I'm here with Wynton Marsalis. That was a real turning point for you musically. I think you're obviously a jazz educator. That's so much of what you do. It's an essential part of what you do. When you have the task of trying to introduce someone to jazz music who has absolutely no idea, maybe they've never listened to a song that's over 3.5 minutes before in their life, you know, the song that has no words, you know, just music. Do you have an immediate entry point? Say, go and listen to that and tell me you don't love it.
I kind of base it on the person.
Yeah.
First, I listen to the range of their voice. People with higher pitch voices generally tend to like higher instruments.
Right.
I check out their pace and their tempo. If they seem like high energy type of people, their concept of who they are in the world. Like, where do they want to be? It's kind of like, what crowd do you want to hang with? And some people want to be gothic. Some people want a lot of tattoos and some people want to be the hipster or go with whatever fad. Some want to be very serious and some have a classic understanding.
I agree. I think the first thing I always try to do with someone who says, you know, I've never liked jazz before, but I'd like to get into it, I take them to see a gig in a club with a really good band, because even if you're not into sport and you see like a great tennis player,
right,
you can't deny the beauty of someone who has dedicated their life to something so that can do so beautifully. Right, and I think, man, you know, when you see a great jazz band, you see it, it's a memory that stays with you.
That's a great idea to give people a live experience, because the music is very different live. Mm. I mean, it's you can feel it has much more impact than it has when it's recorded, because you can feel it. It's like a person talking to you.
Absolutely.
And because I grew up always around live music, I have a tendency to take it for granted. Mm. But I think that that's an important part. And also the fact that you're taking it. Because a lot of the experience in the music is social.
Yeah.
And a lot of the teaching of a thing with a person is you and them being together.
Yeah.
Like the intimacy of teaching, exchange of information. It could be as simple as you learning how to cook something from your father or your mother. You might say, man, this is how you make my pancakes. This is how you make gumbo. But it's more of it about you being there and doing the work and them talking to you, looking at you a certain way. And there's so many things that cannot be communicated, that are not even communicated in words, and it becomes a part of your basic love and feeling for a thing. Because really the only thing that you can communicate to students on a very base level is a love of a thing and a passion and an intensity that does not doesn't have to be expressed in grand gestures or a lot of screaming. I had one teacher that had a stroke and he could barely speak. My trumpet teacher, George Jansen, it was very difficult for me to understand him when he talked to me. But he loved music so much, and he'd teach me cornet solos, and he would start conducting it with one hand. And when he finished conducting, he would tell me, what is this guy saying? But I understood the feeling. He had so much love and warmth. And I remember one lesson that I was not prepared when I was a junior in high school. When I would have my lesson, I was always the last person. All the younger students would hear my lesson in the door, because I had been top trumpet player in my state for 2 or 3 years, and I was not prepared. Like week after week, I would come in, I would be playing gigs, like funk gigs, till 1 or 2 in the morning. I come to this lesson 11:30, 12, after having gone to bed at 4, not serious, and he kicked me out of lesson one day. Yeah. And I could understand him saying, "Get out." And everybody in that row could understand. So just the humiliation of having to put my trumpet in the case and walk past all those students who were like 10, 11, or 12, and they knew, they could hear him telling me, "Get out." And I went home, man. I told my daddy, Jansen kicked me out of the lesson, man. He said, "Why?" I said, "I wasn't taking care of business."
Well, those moments are quite important in some ways, because they do make you a lot more serious. I mean, I remember jam sessions where I've not brought the game, you know, at all, and they make you scuttle back to the woodshed and get your stuff together.
Did you get run out of it?
They didn't need to tell me something. It was like, okay, yeah, it's, you know, when you're not asked to stay for the next tune, it's like you kind of know that the game is up. Okay, well, there's a tune that I kind of sing this in my head a lot. It's called Soul for Sale. It's right in the middle of Blood on the Fields, disc 2, I think it is. It's sung by John Hendricks, written by you. That's a great track. Would you mind if we hear that?
Yeah, check it out. Flowers and hoes, I pass a love the northern dress clothes. Oh, and I'll take those Negroes. Soul for sale.
That was Soul for Sale, sung by John Hendricks, composed by Wynton Marsalis from Blood on the Fields on BBC Radio 2. Hi, it's me, Jamie Cullum. I'm here with Wynton Marsalis on BBC Radio 2. Obviously, you were considered a great, you know, young kind of prodigy when you were in New Orleans, and then you moved to New York to study at Juilliard. Was that a real change for you at that time?
I was 17 when I went to New York. It was a big change because in the South, I always thought that the social conditions were better in the North. Mm. When I got to the North, it was like the same thing and the difference. Like Harlem was rough time for Harlem. I was living in Harlem when I first went. And then they had a transit strike, and I had to walk from like 120-something street down to 66th Street every day with a 4 trumpet case. And then I wasn't used to not looking at people. Like, it's just a basic thing. In New Orleans then, at that time, we would all look at each other. That was before the real hyper-ignorance and violence that came in with rap music. I struggled when I came to New York just to work, to change kind of how I was. It was cold. I'd never been in a cold environment. I had an army jacket. I had to figure out how I was going to make some money. I didn't have anything. You know, I was trying to... In Juilliard, we didn't have dorms or any of that. It was more like you were on your own.
What about musically in Juilliard? Was that a really new experience for you?
Yeah, I had a hard time running with some conductors. Just more like my style. I was Southern and very much like Black from the community. I had trouble fitting in. And the way of talking and the way of being was not... I had a run-in with a conductor early over something. He was addressing me a certain way. I didn't like it. You know, me and my teacher had a run-in. My teacher, William Vacchiano, was the teacher of my teacher in New Orleans, George Jansen, the guy that I talked about who kicked me out of lesson. And Vacchiano and I had a misunderstanding. Also, it was like a racial thing. He was telling me something about white, black trumpet players. I got mad. I look, man, I don't care about what you think about black trumpet players. And then I didn't understand that even just the way I would use the word man... Because I'm from another whole time and another culture, and he's a guy who was in the Philharmonic in 1930s. He had taught everyone, and he actually gave me the greatest lesson I ever received from any human being. He was my teacher for a year. I dropped out of school after a year and a half, and we did not really get along. But for some reason, after I dropped out of school, I was playing jazz. I was playing with Art Blakey. I had not returned to play classical music yet. I was 19. I called him one day and said, can I get a lesson? I went to his house in Queens. First, he offered me a drink, which I didn't drink at that time, just because I was always around alcoholics and always around alcohol and drugs, so I stayed away from it. But because it was him, I said, yeah. So it was like scotch or something that I didn't like. And we're sitting at this table, there's just a light on, and he told me, he said, you're going to be a great trumpet player. You can play. You don't have a problem with that. He said, my son died when he was young, and I had problems with him. He said, my wife is in the back, and she's been an invalid for the last 20 years. He said, she's going to die. He said, when she dies, I'm going to be all alone. And it's very quiet. And he said, you have to make sure you take care of your internal life. He said, if you are successful in your career and your internal life and the people who are around you are not happy, you are not happy. And your life will not be a happy life. And all of the success and veneration and adoration and money and all that will not mean anything to you, because inside it will be hollow and you'll have a bad time.
Another tutor you had at that time, I believe, was Art Blakey.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that must have been a dream come true to learn from someone like that.
Well, I used to sit up in New York with my boy, Akita Tana. He was playing drums with the Heath Brothers, and we were always talking about how could I learn how to play. So we look at Star Trek for 1 hour. It came on at 12 o'clock. So we all said, man, how can I learn how to play? He said, man, the only chance you have to learn how to play is to get a gig with Art Blakey. Then I was 17. So he said, I know James Williams, so I'm going to talk with him, and maybe you can play for Boo. We call Art Blakey Boo. So I had that opportunity, and he gave me the opportunity to play with him and to learn how to play.
And what years for that you played with Blakey?
That's like 80, 81. I was 17, 18, 19.
And who else was in the band at that time?
Charles Fambro. He was my roommate on the road, a great bass player. Mm. Bobby Watson played alto saxophone. Billy Pierce played tenor saxophone. James Williams played piano.
Are there any recordings from that era that you can still hear today?
I hate the way I was playing.
Okay.
I was trying to figure out how to play.
I know what it's like when you listen to yourself.
Yeah,
you know.
It's painful. You know how that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. I was trying to figure out something.
What's your favorite lineup of the Jazz Messengers from Art Blakey?
Man, I mean, he had so many great ones, but I think I like Freddie and Wayne Shorter and Curtis Fuller.
Playing?
This is for Albert.
This is for Albert. Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. This is for Albert from Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. I'm here with Wynton Marsalis. How do you now see the future for young jazz musicians making a living now? You know, you don't really get major labels signing instrumental jazz artists anymore. You know, there are some great working bands out there, but...
I think they have trouble because jazz requires integrity. And I think integrity is in short supply in the world. Everybody wants to be famous. So jazz will test your desire to be famous. The music has never been a music that attracted fame. First generation of people had it. Louis Armstrong, such an overwhelming genius, he became famous. After that, it was the musicians didn't. Charlie Parker didn't have the type of fame Louis Jordan had. And he was not ever going to get it playing the type of music he played. Duke Ellington's band ended up eventually playing the Ice Show. He had to make decisions, and those decisions were either stick with the music and with a certain type of integrity and accept what comes with it or not. It's very difficult for the younger people with the boom and the social media and the ability to congregate a group of people to congregate around you and the whole video and all of these things, which are great tools of communication and which bring the world much closer together and which I think are fantastic developments in my time.
Yeah.
The whole kind of iTunes model and all of the now the cloud.
Well, this is something you've embraced. You know, I know you're active on Twitter and Facebook and things like that. And I find it, you post videos of rehearsals and things.
I love that. I think that that's all great. And I feel that the same thing that liberates also enslaves. So it's just a matter of how you want to use the technology and the media. It's more difficult for the younger musicians because they have. If they can't place themselves in a continuum, then their integrity will be tested. Just like our financial systems, through corrupt practices, over-education, use of nefarious terms, and the attempt to make something that is nothing into something. That's the thing that I find is of interest in many young things, because there's no such thing as a young thing. Things just are. And when you come up with an idea, it's an idea. And from the moment you conceive of it, it was born, it begins to age. And ideas are either of value or they are not of value. And or somewhere in between. But the fact that they were born yesterday does make them more important than, like, you're not necessarily playing notes that are more important than the notes Bach played. Or than the notes Beethoven played. Or than the notes Louis Armstrong played. You are a part of their legacy. And you reflect something in them. You're a Western musician. You play trumpet. You play piano. You reflect something of Thelonious Monk. Something of Franz Liszt. There's something in that of your playing. We're a part of a continuum. So I find for the younger musicians, the greatest challenge is integrity. And they work on music. They're just as serious. There's just as much talent. But I don't know. I think that they're... And by that, I'm not juxtaposing young to be my generation is old, because we had the same problem.
Sure.
Everyone after the kind of rock and roll boom and the separation of the generations and the generation gap and the hyper marketing and the whole kind of way that they were taught to put more emphasis on the packaging than the product is something that has been the United States really innovated in the 1950s. It started to pick up steam and it has become hyper. In the last 10 to 15 years, is what I call super capitalism.
Sure.
On that album, Plantation and Penitentiary, it affects our younger musicians. So we'll see if the group of musicians can come up with the type of integrity that allows them to learn enough to teach their generation what it means to have the soul and the communication that's in jazz.
Okay, well, let's hear. I really want to hear. This is a great track. Super Capitalism from the album From the Plantation to the Penitentiary right now. That was Super Capitalism, a very, very important tune for these times right here on BBC Radio 2 with Wynton Marsalis. It's been an amazing pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. As I said, you've continued to inspire me and tons of musicians, and I love hearing you play. And I would love to just finish off the show hearing... you might have to remind me which album this is from, because I had it on a best of, but it's your band's take on Think of One.
Right, that's a long time ago.
Because I played it on the radio a few weeks ago, and I said, this will be the most dynamic thing you will hear on this radio station all year. You know, it goes from very soft to very loud, and you don't hear that on the radio. So just tell me a little bit about that band and the track, and we'll play
it
out.
That's from 1982 or 83. It's The album is called Think of One, and it was my brother playing saxophone, Branford, Kenny Kirkland on the piano, Jeff Watts is on the drums, and Ray Drummond is on the bass. And it's Think of One Thelonious Monk song. We were young, 21-something, we're trying to do something.
Sounds great to me. Thank you, Winter Marsalis. Great chatting.
Man, thank you. It's been a great pleasure and honor for me. Happy birthday. Congratulations on your daughter. And keep doing all the beautiful things you're doing, Jamie.
Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.